them on.
Hit them up.
Hit them up.
Move them on.
Move them on.
Hit them up.
Raw hard. Cut them out.
Ride them in.
Ride them in.
Cut them out.
Cut them out. Ride them in raw hard.
WSHC Shepherdstown. This is WSHC Shepherdstown and WSHC Worldwide 897WSHC.org. Please know and remember that whatever is presented on this program is not the production or the responsibility of WSHC Shepherdstown or the Shepherd University Board of Governors. This is Interviews 2011 for the 10th of March. We will be listening to a conversation with essayist, writer, novelist, and author, retired professor of writing, publisher, and editor, Eric Larson, whose website is oliveropenpress.com. Mr. Larson is also the editor of Dr. Judy Wood's forensic examination of the events in Lower Manhattan on 11 September 2001, entitled, Where Did the Towers Go? This program is dedicated to Kenny Johanneman, whose eyewitness testimony of the building exploding out of nowhere revealed that there was no jetliner that crashed into it. His words caused him to be silenced by murderers who tried to cover up their deed with a nonsensical story of suicide. This brief video detailing statements that ultimately got him killed can be found at brasschecktv.com. Go to the 9/11 files, then find key 9/11 witness, quote, commits suicide.
We should be able to hear what this man is saying now.
Anything else that you saw? Were you there for the second hit
by
the plane?
Yeah, about 10 minutes later, the second building went off.
Did you see it?
Yes, I saw it. It just blew up. A big explosion. People started running. It was just chaos everywhere. People jumping out. People just kept jumping and jumping and jumping. And you could still see they were alive because they were flailing around.
The FBI has already stepped in to investigate. It could be possibly a terrorist strike.
It could be. It could be because it was the first one went off and then 10 minutes later this just blew up out of nowhere.
Hard to think that that would just be accidental.
No, I don't think it would be accidental.
Back it up, folks. Back it up.
Kenny
Johanneman.
Spell your name.
J-O-H-A-N-N-E-M-A-N-N.
And you were working there?
Yes, I was right there. I was in the I was down in the basement. Came down. All of a sudden, the elevator blew up. Smoke. I dragged the guy out. His skin was hanging off. And I dragged him out, and I helped him out to the ambulance.
Thank you, right?
Now, I had completed this recording yesterday, and I sent the copy to Mr. Larson and also to Dr. Judy Wood. And she had a brief response. I thought I would read that first. Says, Eric, I've been listening to the audio recording. Excellent. Some notes from it. You may not be aware of the purpose of my website. My website was never intended to be the final answer. It was intended to be a life insurance policy while working on a book. I learned early on that dead people keep secrets. So while organizing the material for the book, I put the goodies out there in plain sight. That is, the website was meant as a filing cabinet of information. I don't think I would be alive now, much less have been able to finish the book, had I not put that material out there. Chapter 3. I do not speculate or hypothesize that it was microwave weapons. I give an example of something that causes these same effects and in the same way I talk about tornadoes. I am not claiming a natural tornado struck Manhattan that day either. We should focus on the phenomenon, not the exact gizmo that created it. Otherwise, folks get distracted into arguing over the exact serial numbers. Be careful of this. Trolls love to use something like this to distort in order to discount the book. Note, I have not concluded that the people jumped out. They just went out the windows for some strange reason. The point of the chapter is that what we see cannot be explained by anything we've seen in building fires before. That is, it is evidence that something else was going on. But I do not conclude exactly what it was. It is to open the reader's mind to start looking for more clues. It is not to be used as proof of directed energy weapons, which I fear is what the trolls will latch onto. For Doug, The number of hits on a web search is not evidence of anything except perhaps the success of a psyops. I could do a whole show on debunking the Easter eggs, as I call them. They were planted early, and many have assumed them as fact. I have seen videos inside WTC7, and there were no dead bodies visible. Greg Jenkins' event ended when a security guard put an end to it because the Jenkins crew didn't have permission to be in that room. They were trespassing. Excellent show. It sounded like you two had a really good check. Judy. Today, we're speaking with Mr. Eric Larson. Can you just give yourself an introduction, whatever you like, and we'll get started talking about your work.
I have been a follower of Judy's work for quite a number of years.
Uh-huh.
Overjoyed that her book has now come out. The title of it, the full title, is rather imposing. Where Did the Towers Go?
Yes.
Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11.
Uh-huh.
My interest in the book has to do with my own personal life, I suppose, in some degree. I'm a retired English prof and writer, and now also publisher and editor,
mm-hmm.
having begun a small press after my retirement from teaching.
Uh-huh.
And so this has led me to, you know, try to keep up since the June of 2003. Before that time, I was completely... I had been snookered by 9/11,
uh-huh.
and it was so shocking that I forgot my 10th grade, or say 11th grade, 12th grade, I guess, physics.
Yes.
And my even my junior high science. Unlike Judy Wood herself, who from the first moment she saw the images on television, knew that they were not following the conventional laws of physics. But we were on a little tiny week-long vacation, my family and I had taken along with me to read, among other things, one of the Gore Vidal pamphlet books that he was putting out.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't think this is... unfortunately, my brother-in-law has borrowed them, and he hasn't given them back, so I can't check, but I think it was not Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, but one of the others.
Okay.
In it, he alluded to the... Well, we don't have to get into this. Specifics of this, but the hold down of interceptor aircraft, or the deliberate mismanagement of interceptor aircraft during the time when the airliners were supposedly in the air.
That is a huge part of this story, yeah. and some people went into great detail and analysis and all of this, and you can go on and on about that for hours, literally. But I think the very simple explanation is, if there's no planes to intercept, then you can't intercept them.
That's one possibility. That's a very, very good possibility.
Hmm.
I agree that that's not the real subject for today, but...
yes.
It's just simply that and the influence of a neighbor and friend.
Oh, really?
Who had been much more versed in 9/11 matters than I.
Uh-huh.
Started me reading. And I read. And I began with Mike Rupert's Crossing the Rubicon.
Hmm.
And since that was the first book, and that's why I started with it.
Yes.
I didn't read Thierry Maison's book about the Pentagon.
Okay.
Which preceded Rupert.
Well, Mr. Rupert did have an awful lot of interesting research, you know, the put options and the CIA involvement and going back to Buzzy Krongard and all that.
Oh, yeah.
But then he just completely lost me on this nonsense of peak oil and the fact that, I mean, and this is a whole, I've done a lot of work on this, you know, petroleum is abiotic in its nature and the earth is constantly producing it. So this whole nonsense about, you know, peak oil is just pathetic, and he lost me on that one. So.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Someday you and I will have to talk
about it. Yes, I can send you some links. I actually did several hours some years ago,
uh-huh.
gasresources.net, one J.F. Kenney, and he picked up on the Russians did a huge amount of research. Stalin launched literally a Manhattan-style project to find what is the nature of oil, and they have over 50 years of research. An interesting thing is that Russia is not only the greatest, they produce all of their petroleum, they're also the greatest petroleum exporting nation in the world. Now, we're not supposed to know about that. We're supposed to think, you know, Saudi and the Middle East and all this nonsense, but, you know, whatever. Yeah.
So it's very convenient to have us not realize that.
No, yes.
Well, one thing about crossing the Rubicon,
uh-huh.
I think that Rupert did cast his net too wide. He started painting on too large a screen. On canvas, I think.
That's a very good analogy, yes.
Yeah, tried to put everything in the context of his view of peak oil. And it spread the book thin. It made it a huge, huge book. It did diminish somewhat in impact. He was very, very good on the air flights, though, and the interceptor aircraft.
Okay.
All of the detail regarding that. The book, though, I think probably that next influenced me most was Nafiz Ahmed's book, The War on Truth.
Ah, yes.
Yeah,
I remember that now.
Yeah, he's an amazing fellow. He's a young man still. I think it was in 03.
Yes, I remember that. There's so many parts of the story. I mean...
Yeah.
But he's an Englishman,
yeah.
and of course, you know, the name, of course, well, you know, we can go on about
sure.
people's reactions to different things. This is, in one sense, major sense, a war on Muslim people in general, you know, so whatever.
Yeah, but he's, his first book on the subject, it was not The War on Truth, but a predecessor of that book. Oh, very soon after 9/11, I read it, and it was I reread the second one, The War on Truth, which is an improved and more expanded version of the original. He takes a historical approach rather than a theme approach like peak oil.
Okay.
Simply, he begins with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
Yes.
And the creation through Brzezinski, largely, his influence, the creation of Al Qaeda, and the use of Osama bin Laden to help. Radicalized the Muslim population and the Taliban as a means by which to influence the more rapid expulsion of the Russians from Afghanistan.
Well, and I think Brzezinski and these people, they have admitted that was the point,
yeah.
was to have a war by proxy with the Soviets. You know,
right.
It's just...
Yeah. And then they were, of course, and this is where Nafiz, his whole name is Nafiz Mossadegh, Ahmed, and he had a research center of some kind in Suffolk, England, and has come out with another book, which is A User's Guide to the Collapse of Civilization.
Okay.
I believe it's the full title, right at my elbow.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, he then follows the question after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and after the expulsion, of course, of the Soviets from Afghanistan, the U.S. had developed a extraordinary weapon in the Taliban and in what then they were calling and still call Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
On the basis, so they didn't know quite what to do with this weapon, you know, these forces. So they fought. They used them to fight as mercenaries in the Balkans and also used them to do the bombings in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Of the embassies and the U.S. as whole.
Mm-hmm.
All of these being intended to create in the U.S. the impression and the fear that there was a massive Islamic enemy in the world. And
well, that's been pointed out so many times. You know, Al-Qaeda means the base, and it is wholly the creation and baby of the CIA. And in a sense, you could say it really doesn't exist. It was literally a database of people that they found to be useful, whatever. And then there was also an actual physical base in Peshawar, Pakistan, where they would launch their missions against the Russians. So.
Yeah. It's all amazing, the history. It's so relevant, and it's so clearly a logical set of steps leading up to the present, 2001, and also up to the present. But it's still not widely known.
Well, I think one more thing. To use another quick mention. The gentleman's name, you were saying his whole name, Mossadegh, was in there.
Yeah.
And, of course, remember, Mossadegh was the president, duly elected president of Iran, who was friendly to the West. And then, of course, he wanted more of the profits to go to his own country, and the Brits and the Americans didn't like that so much, so they overthrow him, install the Shah, this brutal dictator, for so long.
Yeah,
so the majority of what's happening in the Middle East is this blowback from that situation.
Well, a whole lot of it is, no question about that. His name is spelled differently, but it is the same.
Okay.
The same name. That's another piece of history that is, if only it were more widely known. I think for me, what made me so excited by my discovery, a friend actually led me years ago to Dr. Judy Wood's website.
Okay.
I began poking around it. I was just overwhelmed.
Amazing wealth of information, of course, that is drjudywood.com.
That's right. Yeah.
And, you know, that's just a whole study in itself. I mean,
yes, it's the whole study in itself. And I can't remember how I began to correspond with her, but I was so impressed that, now you and I, we've been talking here about some past history, back history, which I find shocking and riveting, and it needs to be heard, but it's very, very much being blacked out. But what made her work exciting from the very beginning was that she set aside all of these political historical considerations and focused on, she's so eloquent.
Yes, and
One
thing that has really impressed me about Dr. Judy Wood from the very beginning is that she can explain things in very simple terms. Because, you know, you see this sometimes, somebody's got this big PhD and they got all these degrees, and they're there in some big subject, and I say, okay, can you just kind of, you know, excuse me, I'm just, you know, I can't even begin to approach your qualifications. Just explain it simply so the everyday person can understand it. They can't say anything. They can't. So if you really, I guess my point of all that was, if you can't explain things simply, then you really don't understand them anyway. And Dr. Wood is an outstanding educator in that way by use of examples. And really a lot of it is common sense.
Most of it is. Much, not the theoretical elements of the physics and the studies of waves and electromagnetism, but the actual appearance of what happened before all of our eyes.
Well, I mean, the idea that these soft aluminum tubes, and the idea of the hole of being a cookie cutter hole up to the wing tips. I mean, that is so hysterical. You could take a hammer to these wings and destroy that plane in a matter of moments. You know, they have all these areas you can't even step on them. And you're going to say that this has obliterated concrete and steel like this. And then again, maybe I'll also throw in my favorite example. I think most of it was for Dr. Morgan Reynolds. His analogy is what happened. If you accept the story of what supposedly happened in Lower Manhattan, the perfect analogy would be a bug strikes the windshield of an 80,000-pound truck. Well, not only does this event cause the truck to wreck, but the truck vanishes. You know, we have all these stories about thermite and bombs in the building and, oh, all the steel was carted away to China. Huh?
Yeah.
And then these things they just pull out of thin air with no evidence whatsoever, and we're supposed to think that that's reasonable? I mean,
absolutely. Yes, I'm honored to have been the author of a foreword to Dr. Judy Wood's book. And in a sentence, I thought immediately when you said what you just said about her style. So I wrote, although Dr. Wood's scientific training and understanding are deep and complex, she has the gift of being able, without compromise, to express ideas of the greatest complexity in terms readily understandable to any interested and attentive layperson.
Yes, and her teaching style, though, is she puts the ball back into your court and has you think about it, and then you come up with the explanation, and that's that is the way to educate. It really is.
I think that she must have been an absolutely outstanding professor, and I trust will be again someday.
Yes, hopefully.
There was, in some senses, I told her, and others too, that she was carrying her teaching method a little bit too far when it came to the website.
Okay.
And people tended to get confused, because I did the same method for 35, 40 years.
Okay.
I would try to make the students come up with the answers.
Uh-huh.
Certainly, she's absolutely right. That's the only way in which anything really is remembered in it. It's also flattering to the learner. The learner realizes, oh my God, I did that.
Yes.
It's fundamental. She's absolutely right. But people got confused on the website because they didn't think hard enough about what they were looking at. And of course, unfortunately, we're indoctrinated into the feeling that we shouldn't ever have to work hard with our heads. And so it seemed confusing to many, many people. She did some things. She put a list of beginner's area to click on it, various things. But she mentioned to me once about pulling it together into a book, and I was immediately very excited. But then we went out of touch for some time. She wrote back, a year or two later, said she didn't know how to write a book. I said, oh, sure you do. You take one part of the subject at a time and talk about it.
Uh-huh.
Well, I received an email sometime later, or actually it was around Christmas of 2009. She said, would I mind taking a look at some of her chapters as she got them ready? And I, of course, I said, I'd be deeply, I'd love to. Fascinating, I'll be honored. She was very modest about a chapter at a time. I received by email virtually the entire book the next day.
Unless, again, just point out the name of that Dr. Judy Woods book. It's Where Did the Towers Go? The Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11 by Judy Wood, BSMS PhD.
Yeah. And so here she was, looking at it as doing a forensic investigation.
Mm-hmm.
A book that is a monument to scientific forensics. And she looked at evidence and didn't leave any out. She looked at every available kind and type of evidence from the event, that is to say, physical, observable, concrete evidence, and took these kinds of evidence up one after the other and followed through the entire book in that manner. It is not only the most important, I wrote in my foreword that this is the most important book of the 21st century, and that is not an attempt at all to be just attention-getting or hyperbolic. I think it's the truth.
Uh-huh.
I'd be more than happy to say why in a minute or two when we have time and get around to that.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, that's what needs to be talked about in talking about her book, her study, her work, is that what she's done is simply observe.
Yes.
And the things she saw, I think she's extraordinarily gifted as an observer. Far more. I mean, she would take pieces of physical evidence in the form of a color photograph.
Uh-huh.
She would say, notice the this, da, da, da.
Yes.
I would realize I hadn't noticed that.
Exactly.
Nor would I be likely to. So she's tremendous that way, seeing in the evidence that others have.
Right on the index page of her site, drjudywood.com, right there in the beginning, you have different sections. One of these is the Star Wars directed energy weapons, and these pictures, one thing that's very striking is when you see these cars, like this police car that was over a half mile away from the Ground Zero, and the damage that is sustained, and when you look at this, it's like, how did this happen over a half mile away? And then, of course, you have the Hutchinson effect, where he has demonstrated these things in his lab, and they have a picture of his experiment, and then the direct exact example of what we have at the WTC complex, these exact same phenomena.
Bent and erupted from inside metal rod.
I mean, the idea, it's so bizarre. I mean, these buildings, and then again, looking at this over the years, you know, I've lost different things, but there was at least 47 inner core columns, and there was, I think, 236 outer. So it's basically, it was a building within a building.
Yeah.
These two structure points were latticed together. And the idea, if you believe this pancaking thing, well, first of all, the buildings could have never stood to begin with. And then, of course, one thing Dr. Wood pointed out was, the buildings disappeared in 10 seconds. Can you clap your hands 110 times in 10 seconds?
Isn't that a wonderful...
It's brilliant. It's just
brilliant. I actually tried it.
Okay.
So impossible.
Yeah.
It's obvious. But again, it's an extraordinarily vivid and useful parallel that she uses there. Well, she does, you know, from the very beginning, the first chapter, is not the first chapter, I guess, but the billiard ball effect. That whole series there is extremely effective. The billiard ball example, and talking about free fall time and how much time it would have taken had there been pancaking and so on.
And she said one of her favorite pictures is, I think she calls it the Alka-Seltzer. You see this picture, it's just like a big dusty poof ball.
Yeah.
And is that a building collapsing?
Yeah.
No, it's a building turning to dust. And you see in one point, some of these outer columns are still intact, and you see them turn to dust.
Yeah,
well, how does that happen? A little bit of kerosene?
Exactly.
Huh?
Yeah. I think that one of the things, for example, that most vividly and quickly alerted me to what she was doing, I heard her on the radio once. I'm sorry to say, not the thing to say when I'm speaking to a radio man and on the radio, but oh, well. I don't listen to the radio very much.
Oh, I certainly understand. I mean, I try to. I think what I mentioned the other day, I try to listen to the nationwide talk shows. I was actually trying to listen one today, and it's just amazing. I mean, the amount of actual information they present is basically zero. I mean, they're all about hyperbole, name-calling, and, of course, self-worship, and they want people to call in and tell them how they love them, and it's such an honor to talk to them. This is garbage. It's like, this is supposed to be what? I don't know. But
well, a great deal of what passes for content is in fact intended to muddy the waters and keep people in a state of confusion.
And then, of course, they're always selling something. They're always, they've got something to sell, so.
But what she did in this particular radio show is say one simple thing that I find in the book absolutely riveting as well, and that is, it has to do with the seismic signal.
Ah, exactly.
Yeah, and the building fell in, well, let's just say, running off numbers. They didn't fall first, but the buildings disappeared in 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have the physical impression, the visual impression, that they were collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
But there were seismic vibrations measured in the Earth that lasted only 8 seconds.
Uh-huh.
That means that that's proof positive that the entirety of the buildings didn't hit the ground.
Isn't that something? They went up. The buildings did not come down. They went up.
Yeah.
They turned to dust.
And her, that's right, the dissociation. Molecular dissociation of material is the key to her, I think. I am not a scientist nor scientifically trained. I had high school physics, chemistry, and some math. She builds on common sense and shows how it is mathematically also true.
One area I don't really understand too much at all about is the field effects. One thing that was very interesting, I was watching the Weather Channel maybe last weekend, and they have all these programs, and they have the classic thing about the 2x4 through the telephone pole.
Right, right.
And here on her site, there's a piece of plywood that has gone through a telephone pole. So the thing is, like, exactly what is happening there? Somehow the telephone pole has opened up to accept this thing. It's not that this plywood was going at 100 miles an hour and somehow sliced through the telephone pole. Another thing that she pointed out was Hurricane Erin, which is this most amazing thing. Here is this hurricane that is so large, and it is right off the coast of New York City. And there was a program also on the Weather Channel. They have these things as it could happen tomorrow. It's sort of like this fantasy program. Well, you know, if such and such awful weather event happened, what would be the result? And one of them was a hurricane just as Erin. If it hit Manhattan, Manhattan would be destroyed, okay, because the subways, once those subways are flooded, they would be ruined. You could not just pump them out and it would be destroyed. So here's an event that is so monumental, it's not even reported at all.
That's right.
And that is a huge story.
That's a very, very riveting and revealing fact. I'm not sure where to go from all of this, but she does do a good deal of study in the book tornadoes, and suggests, for example, there's a photograph. I don't know if you have the book in front of you or not, but I can't find. I have mine in front of me, but
uh-huh.
I can't remember who these sections of the images are.
Well, that's fine.
But one of them. Where a storm had gone, a tornado had gone through, there are three or four parked cars, and the three of them are regular, sitting on their wheels, and the fourth one is tipped up upside down.
Yes.
And another photograph in the same kind of context of a hurricane. I'm sorry, a volcano. A tornado. And the car has it has levitated.
Yes.
Resting on a wooden fence and the branch of a tree.
I'm looking at that now, yes.
Are you? Yeah. And, of course, the question is, it must simply have been placed there most gently because the wood is heated. The key here really is in that whole area of field effect. Morning of 9/11, it was just, I mean, here in New York City, it was the most beautiful, purely blue sky day.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew? And television didn't tell people, except one or two channels, I guess, maybe alluded to Erin. Didn't know there was a hurricane. And from an airplane at a low altitude going, I think, into Newark Airport, there is a photograph showing that you can, out of the window of the airplane, you can see the outer banks of the clouds of Erin.
Yes.
Now, simultaneously, Dr. Willis did further meteorological research. And there was at the same time in a very, very, very large high pressure zone coming toward the east coast from the west. So under a clear blue sky, I'm not going to say that I know exactly every detail of this scientifically. I don't, but I do know that I find it convincing when a scientist says that field effects may well be created by these enormous different energy fields, the high pressure and then the hurricane. But there was thunder and lightning at each of the three New York City airports that day.
Okay.
This out of a clear blue sky. Indicating that there has to have been what I think is correct to call field effects in operation. That is to say, there were charges wrapping around.
Yes.
That were not conventionally the kind of, that are generated conventionally as in thunderstorms. So clear sky, blue sky, beautiful day, and lightning and thunder at each of the three major airports. And undoubtedly, there must have been lightning and thunder elsewhere as well, but not recorded because somebody living in third floor walk-up in Brooklyn may not monitor the thunder and lightning in their neighborhood, but at the airports they do. So, and then other, I mean, what I was going to say earlier, and I forgot to finish it, is that reading this book, obviously it's not the work of an hour or two, nor is it the work of a day or a year or two either, to compose and write and research.
Yes.
But it is like reading a detective story. It's riveting. For anybody with a, you know, somebody with the intellectual curiosity, it's a page-turner. I think it's an absolute page-turner. So you get to the part, well, we already alluded to the seismic signals, which are very, very carefully studied and shown not to match a collapse scenario. But Dr. Wood has also done studies in the recordings of the Earth's magnetic field at the time of these events.
Okay.
There are five, and you'll enjoy this when you get to it, five, I don't know if they're called magnetometer stations in Alaska. And they all monitor changes in the electromagnetic sphere on Earth. And graphs in the book are just the most dramatic thing you've ever seen. At the moment when the holes occur in each of the two buildings, there are radical changes in the electromagnetic magnets from those stations in Alaska.
Yes.
Well, it just indicates that some kind of force fields must have been responsible. So in that sense, it's just like a detective story.
Yes. Well, I was going to mention right now, I'm at the site. There is a site specifically for the book, wheredidthetowersgo.com, and it kind of introduces the book, and I'm kind of looking at you. There's a section where you can click on the chapters, and it has some video support.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to have that associated web location.
But, I mean, just if anybody's just, well, of course, if anybody's listening, they want to listen. If someone has still bought the story and they accept it, looking at the Ground Zero, there's a hole. You're going to say that two buildings, 500,000 tons of concrete and steel apiece, they were there, we know they were there, and now they're gone. And what's left? I mean, the general rule of thumb is that when a building is brought down, I believe it's 14% or it's a certain percentage of the, because the rubble is still there. Now you have to haul away the rubble. So there should have been a pile of around at least 100 feet or more of rubble. What do we have? We don't have that. We have the basement being intact. We have people talking about a smoldering pit.
Yes, the basement being intact is tremendously important. There's a photograph in the book showing a second sub-basement. I mean, the second level down and under the tower, a store with, cartoon characters in it.
Yes.
Movie permanently. And they're unharmed.
They're life-size or human-sized statues of Bugs Bunny and these different characters.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an ironic thing because Dr. Wood's also example is that Americans buy this story because we've seen too much Roadrunner. You know, like the Roadrunner goes through the mountain and there's a cookie-cutter Roadrunner hole in something.
She duplicates that in one of the images in the book where there's one of the Trade Center towers shown with a cutout of Roadrunner.
It's just so sad.
Yeah, it is sad.
I mean, to the wingtips. I mean, please.
Yeah, it is. It's tremendously.
And my own. I mean, it doesn't take a degree in physics. I think just to simply understand that if this aluminum, soft aluminum, if a Boeing had actually hit the buildings, it would have wadded up on the outside. It would have fallen to the plaza below. The buildings could have been repaired with basically just superficial damage.
Well, also the buildings could have taken three planes each and
still
survived. It's something while we're specifically talking about the buildings.
Okay.
I would like to say a word or two. I mean, I've spoken about how much of a page turner the book is.
Uh-huh.
But it's also a book full of humanity, and in one chapter in particular, the humanity comes through many, many different places.
Okay.
Through testimonials of first responders and survivors.
Uh-huh.
There are many, many, many things are revealed through these testimonies. I don't know where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
I guess let me forget.
Okay.
What we should talk about next is probably weird fires.
Ah.
Okay, that's one of the chapters.
Okay.
But first, it seems to me that anybody who doesn't find themselves moved and riveted by Chapter 3 called The Jumpers.
Yes.
I don't know, but they must have a bolt or two missing in their soul.
Uh-huh.
It's an astonishing piece of work. And it turns out that, here's again, the eye, the observant eye, Dr. Wood, is astonishing. Who thought to notice that the people standing up way high in the buildings and in the windows, who thought to notice that they were undressing?
Hmm.
And in fact, and once she points it out, you see, my word, it's true.
I haven't heard that they were undressing.
Yeah, just trying to get his pants off, and one of them in free fall is still trying to get his shirt off.
Really?
Yeah. Now, so here's this is just again has to do with field effects and I guess waves. And what happened? It seems this is, I think, probably you'd have to say to some extent hypothetical because none of them survived to tell exactly. But
yes,
through behavior and telephone transcripts, other pieces of data, Dr. Wood arrives at the conclusion. You know, the kind of crowd control devices that are used by the military and also, I believe, by police forces,
where
a certain kind of gun is aimed at crowds.
Yes.
They feel like they're burning up.
Yes.
It has a name, which I can't recall right now. But they're not being burned. But it feels awful.
Uh-huh.
And I believe it's compared in the book to microwaves. But in any case, this seems to have been what those people were experiencing. They weren't experiencing pain, agony from heat of the jet diesel flame at all. But there was a different kind of heat, and it is known that when you feel that from that kind of wave, that if you are covered with anything that's wet, it intensifies it immensely.
Oh.
And,
okay, so this is the sprinklers would have been going off in the buildings.
Well, that's it. And the people were also, you know, some of them were hot from having been near the fire floors. And others were hot from anxiety and sweating. And then comes this attack of these penetrating microwaves, I will call them, although it may not be correct. And Dr. Wood compares this, what they must have felt, to what the person would feel if they were standing in a kitchen talking with someone else and didn't know that the stove next to them, that, you know, the cooking plate on top of the stove next to them was hot because it wasn't glowing or they made a mistake and they put their hand on it. There is nothing whatsoever that intervenes between that pain and the removal of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. I mean, it's even deeper than instinct. I mean, there's no intellectual calculation there whatsoever.
Yes.
And that's what becomes the thesis of the jumpers.
Hmm.
That they jumped just as you would remove your hand from that plate.
Exactly.
Now, maybe not absolutely as instinctively, because they were taking time to try to remove their clothing, but on the other hand, To me, it's still the most horrifying thing about that whole day. To think of leaping from that great of a height is terrifying. And there must be a far greater terror or pain than that fear to propel people.
And I think to do justice to the victims, of course, we have all been victims to a very real degree, but the truth needs to come out. And one thing, I haven't heard it too often lately, but there used to be a crowd of people who were saying that somehow only the people that directly lost legitimacy to comment on this, that's lunacy. This was an attack launched on everyone on the planet.
Yeah, right.
Okay, and it is this.
That's very, very well said. And but speaking too of those who were themselves victims and the families of them, Dr. Wood's book, again and again in this third chapter and elsewhere, she does talk a lot about bringing justice to them and giving them the honor of knowing what was done to them. And that pervades the third chapter.
I just did briefly. I just did a little search on the microwave reference. Here's an article, Gannett News Service, April 2000, entitled "Crowd Control Cookery: Microwaves Among New Non-Lethal Weapons."
Mm-hmm. It's that kind of thing. It's pretty ruthless. Although non-lethal, I was just reading a book where the subject is non-lethal weaponry was being discussed. I wonder what book that was, and how incorrect the term non-lethal can be.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, one more example from inside the building.
Okay.
The time of these microwaves. So, a woman with her companion, that is, a couple of women from our office, they got a cell phone call through to one of their husbands, and they said, the woman who spoke said, we're going to go in the bathroom and soak up a bunch of our clothes, shirt, or whatever, and then wrap them around our noses and walk down.
Okay.
She said, we're fine. It's just going to take a while to walk down all those stairs. And next thing the husband learned, he became a jumper.
She was calm
and collected and recognizing that she could just make a mask, a smoke mask with wet clothing.
Yes.
And then something happened. And what happened, obviously, had to have been that the waves were visited upon that part of the building. I don't know that we ought to talk about it because it would be just so diversionary, but from some of the non-controversial or debatable elements of Dr. Wood's book, but I just fell for Blaine's theory, hook, line, and sinker.
Some years ago, I had a guest. Try to remember this. It was the little sort of supposed documentary in plain sight, and it was I spoke to both of those individuals on two different shows.
Yeah.
And the video where the cartoon plane disappears into the cartoon building, and of course their whole thing was the pod. There's like a yes, there is something on the underbelly of this plane that shouldn't be there on a passenger plane, but the whole thing is just a cartoon to begin with. And the whole thing of the documentary on September Clues, septemberclues.info. And if you just watch that with an open mind, you cannot come away from it without understanding that there were no, I mean, if there were, maybe there were hijacked aircraft, we have no evidence of them. There were certain no Boeings crashing anywhere. You're going to have a Boeing crash, there's going to be an abundance of wreckage. Okay? And now granted, a lot of it's going to go away, but you've got the engines. You've got engines, you've got landing gear, you've got, and also the bodies. There'd be a lot of, you know, remember when the one space shuttle disintegrated? And there was some weird things about that too, but that's a whole other, I actually did a program on that some years ago. Anyway, the point I was trying to recall was that they actually recovered body parts from these unfortunate people that blew up how many miles in the atmosphere?
Yeah.
And here we have something that's just a few hundred feet above the ground. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, one of the things, in Where Did the Towers Go, Dr. Wood has a passage about the planes and no planes, and refers, I think she may make reference to Morgan Reynolds, who's done probably more work on that than anybody, as I understand it. But she doesn't dwell on it. It's because it's got other things to dwell on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, the observable evidence that there's just no way, really, that it can be considered controversial. So let's go, if you want to, if you do, I do, go to Weird Fires.
Absolutely.
This is immensely
now, in the so-called 9/11 truth movement, which I think is just sort of a COINTELPRO style, you know, managing the people that are questioning these things, is that they have a thing about molten. There was molten metal in the building, and there was molten metal for months and months and months, which is just, you know, ridiculous. I mean, if you did have say a steel foundry and steel, you poured it out on the ground, it's not going to stay molten for very long.
No.
You know, and then the thing about these earth moving equipment, they were pulling out this orangey glowing metal, which was really weird. Now, if it was molten, obviously the machine couldn't pick it up.
Well, not only that, but even if it weren't molten but still red hot and yellow hot, which the photographs make it look, and I mean, I know that one that you're referring to, Dr. Wood is very, very careful to point out that it is universally known in the industry that hydraulic equipment of that kind will freeze up and be destroyed.
Exactly.
Over 180 degree Fahrenheit temperatures.
Exactly.
And with something in its jaws in the thousands of degrees Fahrenheit, it's going to destroy the hydraulics. And so the conclusion is this: that stuff may have been glowing.
It was not hot.
But it wasn't hot.
Hmm.
It is an incredibly ingenious sentence someplace in the book. And it goes, I hope I have it correct. I know I have the idea correct. I do not have all the wording correct.
Yes.
But things that are hot glow.
Mm-hmm.
But not everything that glows
is hot.
It's hot.
Very good.
Yeah. And the molten metal, there's no reason to assume that with this dissociation, molecular dissociation process going on, no reason to rule out the idea that that dissociation could lead to moltenness. But that's not proof that it was hot.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the story that there was some molten metal below ground for months, well, it's... This is not true.
Well, the pictures of the cars that are on fire are fully involved, and then there's just stacks and stacks of paper that is all around and not burning. And see, that's another point here.
Yeah.
All these, and the firefighters, they said that there was the only thing he saw that was discernible, that it was possibly from an office, was like a little piece of a telephone keypad. There were no file cabinets. There were no computers. There were no toilets. There were no stairwells. How many stairs were in there? Everything was vanished, was turned to dust. So this is what the data is presenting us. So the question is, how does that happen?
Yeah.
And a soft aluminum tube with kerosene in it does not make steel vanish.
No. The Hutchison effect can make steel vanish.
Yes.
It can,
the jelly, molten metal, the jelly metal types of things.
Right? Yeah, and it causes levitation.
Yes.
And it causes eruption from inside of substances, of solid metal substances, causes weird fires. The Hutchison effect can make fires begin to flicker around on objects, but they're not hot, and then they go away. The fires that aren't hot is essential. There's a long testimonial by an EMS worker who, with her partner, was called from Brooklyn and told to go across to Manhattan and get down to the Trade Center area as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's heat, and then there's heat. Clearly, the people who jumped from the building, they were in agony. There cannot be any question of that.
Mm-hmm.
But crossing the Manhattan Bridge in their ambulance, this pair of EMS people felt tremendous heat on their faces. And they were, it's in the book exactly what the distance is between them and the World Trade Center site.
Mm-hmm.
But it was unpleasant. It didn't burn them, but it was just hot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that. Then they arrived there, parked the ambulance, and do as instructed, which is to run to the site. And they get separated. And the young woman whose testimonial this is right there as the building disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pitch dark. Just again and again and again, you read about this pitch darkness. You also read again and again and again about how there was something smoke-like. But Dr. Wood she won't call it smoke, because that implies a conventional fire.
Mm-hmm.
But this presence in the air was cool.
Mm.
There was a coolish feel to it. Well, I mean, there are people who survived from being in the lower levels, first level basement, places like that. Even on, I think, one case of first floor entry level. And the buildings disappeared, and they walked out astonished to see just empty area the size of a football field.
Yes.
But this EMS worker, this has to do with the weird fires, she couldn't see anything, but her hair caught on fire. Her sneakers caught on fire. Her duty jacket caught on fire. And she just kept running. She was a little bit happy for the fire because she could see a little bit better. That is to say, she could see some. Anyhow, she ran and relocated the ambulance, and her partner was there already by then. She said to him, get as many people as you can into this ambulance and drive straight north. Let's get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
In the morning, she woke up with just a couple of bruises.
Uh-huh.
She wasn't burned. So again and again and again, the assumption is that if there are flames, there's heat. But that can't be the assumption in this case.
Yes. Well, there's just so many avenues you could go down. I mean, I just did, I plugged in Building 7 in BBC, and you get reams and reams and reams of information of how the BBC reported a full 23 minutes before Building 7 went away. I mean, I can play the video right now. It basically starts off in London or something, and the presenter is saying, well, the Solomon Brothers building has, it was weakened due to falling debris.
Yeah.
And then here's the lady with the building right over her left shoulder, I believe, is still standing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, how that building went away, and the post office building that was directly across the street. None of the rubble even crossed the street.
No. That's amazing. See, speaking again, though, of just the waves and field effects.
Yes.
That building, the one that, Larry Silverstein. Yeah, well, we know all about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm so astonished that.
And Giuliani is another.
No. I think that he's very morally. If Dante were writing The Inferno again, he would have to find new places for some of these people.
Yes.
But something I had not known until I read Dr. Wood's book is that building, the Larry Silverstein building, World Trade Center number 7,
mm-hmm.
which was 45. Floors high, I believe.
At least 47,
and
I think.
47, and disappeared about 5:20 that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
All afternoon, it had been, I think she called it fuming.
Yes. Fumes. Mm-hmm.
Frothing up, I think. And all along its east face, there was what, again, most people would call smoke.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Wood won't permit it to be called smoke because it isn't. But it indicates that for that whole afternoon, the effects of this field of energy were being trained on the building,
mm-hmm.
and it was decomposing all afternoon, as indicated by the fumes.
And I do remember somebody giving an eyewitness account of there being a lot of dead bodies in Building 7, even in the morning, way before it went away.
Oh.
And I believe the official story is, of course, nobody died in Building 7 because they all got out.
Right. I know nothing about. I'd like to know more about that. There would be some form of damage to these people's bodies from field effects, if I'm using that term correctly. Some kind of zapping.
Well, actually, I just plugged that in, dead bodies in Building 7.
Yeah.
You get a lot of hits on that. Basically, it was somebody Jennings,
Robert Jennings?
Or Barry Jennings, I believe, and I'm trying to get the story up, just basically says that he had to step over dead bodies of victims as he attempted to vacate the building, and this was in the morning, but
yeah, it's obvious, isn't it, that the anecdotal evidence has to be cautiously used and taken with some skepticism. But
Dr. Wood is very good about that because I guess maybe it's just a human thing. We come up with an idea and a hypothesis and we want to read something into it. And of course, Dr. Wood won't even say, like the silly, I wouldn't use it myself, the silly little inside job story. I mean, we need to stick to the facts and address.
Yeah. That's crucial. crucial to her work, and it's absolutely. It makes this book. It's so significant. It's just I can hardly express it.
Mm-hmm.
She has a section on toasted cars.
And yes.
That she doesn't want to use burned, and she doesn't want to use baked, and she doesn't want to use scorched, because they all imply oxidation.
Yes. That's just amazing. I remember the first time I saw that, I was actually speaking with her on my program, and I had her site up, and I was the first time I'd seen that. I hadn't heard about that. And it's just amazing to see these cars. It's like one police car. The front, I believe it's the front portion of it, just completely looks like it's burned. But then right at the back door and beyond to the rear of the car, it's just it's pristine. It's like it's freshly waxed.
Yeah.
And it's like, how could that happen? If it was near a fire that caused the front part to have damage like that, then all of it would have...
Yes, or as she points out, at least the demarcation between the burned and the unburned part would
yes,
be razor sharp.
Exactly.
And there are other examples where that razor sharp definition is not even at the point where there's a door jam,
mm-hmm.
but right smack in the middle of a flat pane of automobile
uh-huh.
metal. There again, it's clear that these the forces that did that were not forces that have anything to do with
mm-hmm.
professional oxidization.
And immediate eyewitness testimony is very important. Dr. Wood has at her site somewhere. There's I believe it was Porter. She was right there on the ground, and a gentleman came out. He was actually a firefighter from California, and somehow he was visiting. And his testimony, he was saying all the fire trucks that were burned and twisted and windows blown out. And then he goes, well, probably from falling debris. But when you look at those pictures, there was no falling debris that did the damage to these vehicles.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, you know. What's the reason?
This also, debris can't explain why some fire trucks are upside down next to ones that are untouched and seemingly unharmed. Nor can debris explain why there are toasted cars and other vehicles right underneath trees with green leaves
yes.
still on them.
Yes.
So that the trees weren't affected, the leaves weren't affected, and of course also on the day there, you know, it was raining paper. There was
yes.
every place. None of it caught on fire. Now, again and again and again, there are examples shown of fire. No, I can't say that. of flame right next to and even touching paper, and the paper hasn't ignited, but it.
WSHC Shepherdstown. And this is WSHC Worldwide, 897WSHC.org. Interview is 2011 for the 10th of March. And, of course, we need to remember that what you are hearing is not the responsibility or the production of WSHC Shepherdstown or the Shepherd University Board of Governors. I'm speaking with Mr. Eric Larson, editor of Dr. Judy Wood's book. It is the forensic examination of what happened to the WTC complex on 11 September 2001. Mr. Larson's website is oliveropenpress.com. And, of course, Dr. Judy Wood's site is drjudywood.com. And then, of course, there is a website for the book, Where Did the Towers Go.com. And one more time, I sent a copy of this to Dr. Wood, and she had a couple comments. I just wanted to reiterate that. She says that, I do not speculate or hypothesize that it was microwave weapons. I give an example of something that causes these same effects, and in the same way I talk about tornadoes. I'm not claiming a natural tornado struck Manhattan that day either. We should focus on the phenomena, not the exact gizmo that created it. Otherwise, folks get distracted into arguing over the exact serial numbers. Be careful with this. Trolls love to use something like this to distort in order to discount the book. And also, note, I have not concluded that people jumped out. They just went out the windows for some strange reason. The point of the chapter is that what we see cannot be explained by anything we've seen in building fires before. That is, it is evidence that something else was going on, but I do not conclude exactly what it was. It is to open the reader's mind to start looking for more clues. It is not to be used as proof of directed energy weapons, which I fear is what the trolls will latch onto. And also the commentary, for me, the number of hits on a web search is not evidence of anything except perhaps the success of a PSYOPs. And I should have known better because I believe the things that I referenced came from Mr. Alex Jones. So, my bad. I could do a whole show on debunking the Easter eggs, as I call them, these glowing little red balls. It's really weird. They were planted early, and many have assumed them as fact. I have seen videos inside WTC, and there were no dead bodies visible. Greg Jenkins' event ended when a security guard put an end to it because the Jenkins crew didn't have permission to be in that room. They were trespassing. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, there's one filing cabinet was found, but not from, it was from a next door shop. I can't remember, an ice cream store or something. But in it, it looks like it's been in a compactor. But again, with a scientist who has the sharpest of eyes, she points out in one of the images of it. Note the paper, pieces of paper. I think she uses scraps. I don't know, but. As it got compacted, some pieces of paper got stuck, and there they were. The whole thing is just looks as though it had been in the inferno itself.
Mm-hmm.
But the paper didn't burn. So it's clearly not high heat as we conventionally measure high heat in coincidence with what we call fire.
Mm-hmm.
So it was another form of energy. I suppose maybe it would be a good idea, too, for people are wondering what the book is like. It would be important also to suggest the way in which it's rooted in history.
Okay.
And that would mean going back to Nikola Tesla.
Yes.
And Dr. Wood does this.
The Scalar Wars, I've tried to look at that before. There's a famous book of Tom Bearden. He was a lieutenant colonel, U.S. Army, retired. I'm not sure he still is with us, but Scalar Wars. I have something. It's called Scalar Wars: The Brave New World of Scalar Electromagnetics.
I see.
And Nikola Tesla says electric power is everywhere present in unlimited quantities and can drive the world's machinery without the need of coal, oil, gas, or any other of the common fuels.
Yeah.
And then Bearden's response, at any point and at any time, one can freely and inexpensively extract enormous electromagnetic energy flows directly from the active vacuum itself.
Yes, yes. I now remember what book I was reading in which it was said that non-lethal weaponry can be pretty lethal. It's a book related to exactly what you're saying. It's from the middle 90s. It went into a second edition and something like a 10th printing. It's called Angels Don't Play This Harp.
Mm.
And the harp is, of course, the AARP.
Yes.
Which stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project.
Mm-hmm.
It's up in Poker Flats, the north slope of Alaska. And this book is by Dr. Nick Begich and Gene Manning. And they've named their press that they brought the book out through Earth Pulse Press. Now, that's a book that a person might want to read, at least the parts of it, in conjunction with Dr. Wood's book, because HARP research, the use of aiming radio waves up at the ionosphere, which is what they do in HARP, for various reasons and with various effects, but they can alter the ionosphere, they can cut holes in the ionosphere, and they can have these waves bounce back from the ionosphere to Earth with varied purposes in mind.
Uh-huh.
Not very many of them at all.
I believe the chemtrail phenomenon is partially due to that, so they can bend their waves across the curvature of the globe. I've never really even looked into that much, and at first, when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, well, that's just...
Yeah.
However, though, 5 days ago, interestingly enough, at around 7:30 in the morning, the sky around here was crisscrossed with these chemtrails. And in such a way, when you look at them, I actually took a few pictures, managed to take a few pictures with my cell phone. They are not classic condensation trails.
No.
If you just, and again, no PhD in physics required, a little bit of common sense maybe and an open mind.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very huge subject, and it seems to me a tremendous business of a scandal that things are being done to the atmosphere and in the atmosphere and to the Earth and within the Earth that the world's people aren't being informed about at all. And HARP is one of the agencies or outfits or organizations doing this. It's very, very heavily done, what you say, populated by military and corporate guidance. I despair that any degree of accountability to the people of the earth is being very strongly considered by any of these people and what they're doing. It's most alarming. What's so significant about Dr. Wood's book, I think, is that this is a book that shows the actual proof that to speak about these things is not to speak about science fiction. And so that, for example, by the time you get toward, it's about the last third of the book, chapter 17 is devoted to the Tesla-Hutchinson effect. There's info on Tesla. Another one, a piece of information on George Pigott, who in the late 1800s into the early 19s, he managed in his laboratory to create levitation so that he had found out how to take balls of steel and make them levitate up into the air and stay there. Well, he's not well known. And another person named Edward Leitzkalnin, who is a Latvian, moved to the U.S. and built what he called his coral castle.
Ah, yes, exactly, yes.
Well, it appears that what he did was take these large blocks of coral and levitate them into place. He learned how to levitate large bodies of material and maneuver them into place. Another person, Thomas Townsend Brown, is discussed, and something called Project Winterhaven. And it was in 1953 that Brown founded the Townsend Brown Foundation and attempted to gather together something called the Project Winterhaven, which is going to be a large consortium of scientific interests and scientific institutions who could together do research that had already been proven, in fact, to have a basis in, for example, Pigott's levitation. And he was sounding very much like Tesla. This is in 1953, and the project was to harness that, what you just read, energy that would produce transportation at speeds greater than rocketry can and without any pollution, so on and so forth. Well, he was sidelined, and the Project Winterhaven never came to pass. Again and again and again, these examples are seen. Tesla himself, when he died, he was building the tower on Long Island. The town is in or near, I can't name, I wish I could.
Wardenclyffe was the name of the...
what is it?
Tesla's Wardenclyffe would have been able to supply energy, if not that itself, but it could have been a prototype, and it would have delivered electricity to everyone on the planet without wires. It could have also powered motor vehicles, airplanes, everything. And then Mr. Morgan, J.P. Morgan, found out that he couldn't charge for it. Once that genie's out of the box, you can't put a meter on it.
Yep.
And he canceled Mr. Tesla in a real sense.
Yes, I myself have suspicions about how that cancellation actually went.
Of course, the FBI, as soon as Mr. Tesla died, FBI went in there and stole all of his research work. Now, this zero point thing is really technical, and I don't even want to pretend to how to even describe it, but maybe I could read one little quote here about the zero point. What does that mean? First, it describes a vacuum. First, we think that the creation of a vacuum is just taking all the gas out of the space, and then later we're contained thermal radiation. It might be done by cooling. So the second concept is getting the vacuum down to absolute zero. But then it says, both theory and experiment have shown that there is a non-thermal radiation in the vacuum and that it persists even if the temperature could be lowered to absolute zero. Therefore, it was simply called zero-point radiation. And then maybe a quick quote again from Bearden. For our very survival, it is absolutely imperative that informed citizens be aware of this dramatic change, which is just now starting. This powerful new science and engineering must be controlled and used for humanity's benefit, not its detriment. Else, it will eventually be let loose unrestrainedly to destroy all life on Earth, a possibility indicated by Nikita Khrushchev in 1960.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's continued since, and continues to this day. I don't know of any book, well, I just alluded to this book,
mm-hmm.
Angels Don't Play This Harp.
Okay.
And now, that's one. That is a book. But other than that, I can't think of a single book except Dr. Woods that clues us in onto the reality of these means of energy use.
Yes.
That's why... maybe I should do this now rather than at the end, because if I try to do it at the end, I'm sure I'm going to forget.
Well, certainly, whatever you like.
Yeah, well, the reason that I called this, in writing the foreword, I'm going to do just a teensy bit of reading.
Certainly.
So, the foreword begins this way. The book you hold in your hands is the most important book of the 21st century. Let me explain why I say such a thing, and it's going to dovetail with what you just have been saying
mm-hmm.
and reading. Where Did the Towers Go is a work, assuming that its content and message are properly and fairly heeded, and that would include not banned or suppressed,
mm-hmm.
a book that offers a starting point from which those who genuinely want to do it can begin first to rein in and then perhaps even end the wanton criminality and destructiveness of a set of American policies that took as their justification and starting point the horrific events of September 11, 2001. In short, what I was first hit by is how powerful a tool Dr. Wood's book is in letting people be informed of the extent and degree, the monstrosity and the malice of things that are being done to them in the name of forces, powers, organizations that will not reveal any real truth to the people who are going to suffer. The 9/11 is pivotal in the sense that all American policy from that point on has been justified
exactly.
by it.
Mm-hmm.
The irony is all over the place. One of the ironies is that many people say, well, yes, Iraq, may potential for war in Iran, war in Pakistan, war in Afghanistan, war in Northern Africa now, not the uprisings, I don't mean, but I mean the American presence in AFRICOM, is that
yes.
what they call
it? Yes.
But all of these are energy related, that the Western power wants to get the source of particularly fossil fuels. Under control.
Mm.
But we don't need fossil fuels.
No.
And so the world is being turned upside down. Millions upon millions of people killed, put into suffering, exiled.
Probably 90-some percent of all of our problems would evaporate with the ending of petroleum, using petroleum.
It's astonishing. I used to say, and this was before 9/11, it was through the 90s, I used to say that if I were king, the first thing I would do would be to, in the U.S., the first thing I would do would be to decriminalize drug use. And I was under the impression at that time that taking away the profit motive from the sale and distribution of drugs would simply diminish their use enormously.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obvious. There's law enforcement against prohibition. I've presented their work at times. You know, I mean, you create a criminal class that's unwise. It's also it's not a constitutional. The government does not have any constitutional legitimacy to tell you what you can or cannot take into your body, and that includes something that may even harm you and kill you. Okay,
yeah.
So we're going to create this. You know, blah blah blah. Go on and on. I mean,
yeah, oh, absolutely, me too. But I joined the Drug Policy Alliance and paid my dues and received their literature, but I'd given up. Because I know a lot more now than I did then about where the drugs come from.
Yes.
And who it is that's keeping the drug industry going. And it's our own agencies, the CIA itself. And,
oh, yes.
That,
it's no question.
Yeah. And why was it that after the so-called first invasion of Afghanistan, was it 2003?
I probably.
But in any case, so Poppy There were no poppies growing that year.
Exactly.
But the next year, why? They were way back up to production.
The greatest crop it ever had. I mentioned that in my last program, you know, how you can find these videos of these Marines, and they're being interviewed about how they don't like much the fact they're guarding the poppy fields, but that's what they're being told to do.
Well, yeah, so our own agencies and our own powers need those drugs. And so for me, as a private citizen, to try to... Well, I mean, I should probably still belong to them. I mean, maybe there can be some incremental good done in things like making medical marijuana legal and things of this kind, but I don't dispute that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've read, for example, there are two books by a writer named Doug Valentine. I think he goes by Douglas on his books. But they're a pair of intensely detailed historical books on the history of the drug war in the U.S. And he begins way back in the 20s and comes way up to, you know, now.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it called? The Power of the Force, the Power of the Wolf, I think is the first one, and then the second one is called The Power of the Pack. A person who reads those, they're not easy because they're very highly detailed, but if there's any detail about the drug enforcement agencies that you want to know, mm-hmm. it'll be in those books. And of course, it's just completely disillusioning to anybody who thinks that things can possibly be made decriminal. Decriminalized, because there's too many interests built in to the corporatocracy and our own corpo democracy.
Well, so much of the medical industry is just a complete scam. I mean, a huge thing, there's a board-certified oncologist in Rome, name is Tullio Simoncini. Just do a search on cancer as a fungus. Call cancer is no great mystery. You don't need to mutilate the body with radiation and chopping it apart and chemically destroying it. It is cancer, what we call cancer, is simply the body's reaction to the presence of a fungus. And it is destroyed by sodium bicarbonate, baking soda. And he's been doing this for 20 years.
Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, who's the health ranger? Mike Adams. Has on the internet. I believe he calls himself the health ranger, and what his report is called, I can't remember, but he's just so full of information
mm-hmm.
about exactly these, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are. Vested interest, profit motive, and secrecy from the people. That seems to be the formula. In the case of something like Dr. Wood's book, the secret is out regarding at least this area
mm-hmm.
of weaponry. With her book available, we don't have to be, we can't be lied to
mm-hmm.
thoroughly ever again, as we've been lied to so far. With the suppression of Tesla.
Healthranger.org, Mike Adams?
Yeah, that's a very highly recommended site by me.
Mm-hmm.
And he would know all about, is it Santini or?
Tullio Simoncini. All you have to do is look up cancer is a fungus.
Okay.
And when that slaps you in the face, it's just, it's astonishing. What a scam of epic proportions. Just like the one thing that got me the most in trouble I used to look into is that HIV would be a problem if it existed. There is no virus that can be called human immunodeficiency, and that is a subject that is just very huge. I used to go into it, and it used to be most upsetting to people. It's like, well, how can you challenge what I know? I've been told my whole life, and you know what, a lie repeated often enough becomes the truth.
Yeah, Gary Null is extraordinary.
Exactly.
Yes, it's a fakery. The suffering among people that this fakery perpetuates and creates is absolutely immoral. Beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And back in 2006, as I was becoming more and more plagued by these kinds of lies and deceits, and by mm-hmm. the failure of the public to become aware of them,
mm-hmm.
or to arm themselves against them, I wrote a book called A Nation Gone Blind.
Okay.
Its subtitle is America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit.
Mm-hmm.
And it argues that partly in a literary book, and argues for in a literary context, but also in a non-literary context, that Americans have been so indoctrinated by mass media and other kinds of influence and training that they don't really even see things anymore.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They don't see them for what they are.
Well,
they see them in accordance with the way they've been prepared for being seen.
Well, as shown by so many things, not the least of which SeptemberClues.info, whoever perpetrated this farce, this scam, this psychological warfare nonsense, had control and has control of the American media, the Anglo-American media.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, this idea, there's just so many ways to go through this. I just...
Yeah. Gee, maybe I'll give myself another plug.
Go ahead, absolutely.
That is the subject of a book of mine that's coming out within a couple of weeks.
Okay.
And the book is called The Skull of Yorick.
The Skull of Yorick.
Yeah, and then the subtitle is The Emptiness of American Thinking in an Age, at a Time of Grave Peril. And then there's a third subtitle, which is Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11.
Okay.
And it's exactly what you just were saying.
Well, I mean, it's almost hard to find people that have the command of the English language. These people, these nationwide talk show hosts, most of them can't even use their pronouns properly. That just irks me. You know, you can't figure out how to say whether you should use I or me. I mean, what? I don't know.
I don't know. It's very despairing, isn't it? Meanwhile, we're having a union busting going on. Attacks on the teachers going on. All in the name of budget crises.
Mm-hmm.
That exist only because of the $1 trillion of money that have been stolen from the pockets of the taxpayers.
Well, that was the point. Yes, I mentioned briefly yesterday, we were chatting, Richard Grove was someone who, here's a brief statement on him. Richard Grove used to work for Silverstream Software on the 98th floor of World Trade Center 1. And exposed insider trading between a few companies also based in WTC, Marsh McLennan, AIG, and Silverstream. He broke down the information into an audio recording back in 2006 he called Project Constellation after the style of visual works by suicide artist Mark Lombardi. And actually, 4 years ago, I read that. I read it over the air, and it took a while. I guess nobody chased me out of here, but I read that entire thing, and it's really something. You know, he was going to be in a meeting there when the tower first exploded. A lot of people, because when you steal trillions of dollars, it doesn't just happen overnight. And there's the stories of all the gold in the basement that sort of disappeared. And they did find the one dump truck that was kind of hastily discarded that still had some gold in it. So it's like, you never hear much about that, do you?
Make waste.
Yeah.
And, of course, the number of records in World Trade Center 7 that were destroyed, having to do with finances of enormous consequence. It's sort of parallel to the fact that the so-called attack on the Pentagon didn't attack the side where the high-ranking
were,
but it attacked the side where the records were kept. But how many trillion was it that the CIA...
Well, Rumsfeld had just announced the day before, literally the day before, that there was $2.3 trillion missing, and the accountants that were working on that just so conveniently got murdered by this bunker buster.
Yep.
You know, and of course the aerodynamics of all that, I've gone over so much, you know, I mean, I guess I can say it briefly, this summer, whatever hit the Pentagon, it... Of course, the whole story is, you know, this guy that can't fly a Cessna manages to do this, which pilots that actually fly those things say they could not if they turned off all their communication equipment and et cetera. Anyway, so this aircraft is coming at the Pentagon, and instead of just crashing into it, it does a turn, a tight turn, 270 degrees around the Pentagon, and then hits this one area, which, of course, is aerodynamically impossible for a Boeing to do. And you can, that's mostly what I focused on at first. You can dissect that into just millions of little pieces, and it's just,
yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah. On the subject of being blind, I haven't...
It's a willful blindness, too.
Willful. And also, yeah, involuntary blindness. You know, in a sense, maybe the same as willful blindness. But here's an example.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chapter in Dr. Wood's book about exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That I was having lunch with some old colleagues, and I say old because we are all retired. One of them I hadn't seen for a few years, and he was at one time married to a woman who was, she was actually worked in government, still does, was the daughter of an airline pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the lunch, when we were breaking up, I said to my friend, I can't remember, but I asked, I said, or, oh, I know now what it was. Oh, he had had Howard Zinn come down and speak or be part of a program of some kind at his university.
Okay.
I've written very negatively about Howard Zinn, and in my new book, The Skull of Yorick, Howard Zinn, two essays dedicated to him, and I'm not a follower, I'm an opponent. So the subject of Zinn made me roll my eyes, and he said, oh, why is that? And I said, well, among other things, he's part of the cover-up of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a big, big, huge amount of material to introduce in the last 2 minutes of saying goodbye after the lunch.
Uh-huh.
But I said, well, I don't know where to start. For example, the Pentagon, that was not an airplane, and certainly not an airliner, large aircraft.
No.
And he said, he looked aghast, and he said, huh. But, you know, let's call her Judy. Well, that's not good, because her Dr. Wood is Judy, so let's call her Susan.
Okay.
So he said, oh, Susan saw it. And she's the daughter of an airline pilot. And she saw it, and she knows that it's an airliner. Well, there's so many things wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, first, maybe she has an office nearby. What are the odds that she'd have been looking out the window at that particular instant?
Mm.
First, very few, very slight, extraordinarily remote. And secondly, whether she's the daughter of an airline pilot or not, you see what you see.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily see what's there.
Well, you're reminding me of years ago when I used to have Dr. Fetzer as a guest. He was very good at breaking down those types of situations about eyewitness testimony. Of course, you know, he was a military officer and everything like that, so we had some good conversations along those lines.
Well, he's done all that work on the JFK assassination.
Yeah.
Certainly that's an enormous element.
Well, that was my first program with him. And at this point, I'm not even sure. I know it was at least January 04. It might have been September 03, but at this point, why does it even matter? He has just this unbelievably encyclopedic information about what happened that day, as do a lot of people. But then that sort of naturally dovetailed into this story. And I try to bring it up a lot, but to me, this whole 9/11 story, can you ever think of a case when a date was referred to only by the number of the month and the number of the day?
No.
And it just lends to the cheesiness of this prepackaged psychological warfare. 9/11, 9/11, you don't have any rights because of 9/11. Oh, this is bizarre.
Speaking about things done that are then lied about and suppressed and kept out of the view of the people, James Fetzer, along with a fellow who goes by two different names, and one of them is Three Arrows.
Ah, yes.
You know the book? They wrote a book together.
Yes.
Called American, I think, is it American Assassination? I'd have to go down the hall and look at the title. On the death of Senator Paul Wellstone.
Ah, exactly.
And I must say, there's a book that, again, like the book, The Angels Don't Play This Harp.
Yes.
In that small, tiny, the catastrophic event, the murder, I go right ahead and say it, I believe it, the murder of Paul Wellstone and a member of his family and his crew. That book is extraordinarily convincing.
Well, you know, actually, I spoke with Fetzer right around the time when that came out, and he went into those things in great detail.
Yeah.
How the official story was like it was weather, and it was somehow icing. Well, the radar pictures proved that was not the case. And also, these pilots were extremely experienced. They had just been recertified.
Yeah.
And then also, the very interesting coincidence of how the FBI was there immediately. They would have had to have to travel to get there. They had to leave before the aircraft took off. And he just went on and on, and that was years ago.
No, the book is, it's as successful a forensic investigation into that event as Dr. Woods is a successful forensic investigation into what happened on 9/11. It's indispensable. And it's an atrocity. It's an awful thing.
Actually, it was 2004, James H. Fetzer and Don Four Arrows Jacobs published American Assassination, The Strange Death of Senator Paul Wellstone. And he had just been in the face of, I guess it was Father George, about probably Iraq
or something else. And a lot of dead bodies around the bushes, it seems to be. You know, it's like...
Cheney threatened him.
Yes.
It was at the time of voting yes or no on the
invasion. Mm-hmm.
And Cheney, is this you can look up, said we'll make things very difficult for you if you don't vote up.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't. He voted against.
Mm.
I'm sorry to be so gloomy, but I'm afraid that we have allowed, and it's not because of this sleepwalking nation that has gone blind, we have allowed ourselves to be taken over by a large, huge, immense, not just government, but corpo government and corporative and Pentagon influence.
Well, it goes back some way. One time, some years back, I read the work of Major General Smedley Darlington Butler. It's a very short little treatise, War is a Racket.
Absolutely.
And this is talking about the first part of the Great War, World War One. And that sums it up. He goes into how these tremendous profits companies realize in these war issues. And of course, there's the famous thing about Eisenhower's statement warning us about the military, industrial, congressional, media, intelligence complex or something. You know, it's like,
which I think, first Smedley Butler, when there was a group of financiers and financier-influenced people who wanted to have a coup d'etat against FDR.
That was something I played one time. Yeah, I'm sure you can still find it. It's BBC Radio 4. And it's called the 1933 White House Coup. And it was a fascist coup, a takeover of the big families in this country. And Butler, he thwarted this. And I guess that was the New Deal. FDR made a deal with these people. He said, well, you lay off my New Deal programs and I won't hang you for treason.
There you go.
So,
I'll tell you, they chose the wrong guy.
Yeah.
They chose Butler.
Exactly.
That's a great story. And it's also a terrifying story.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we have. That is our government now, the military industrial complex.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And all of this wonderful energy, their first impetus is to make it destroy something.
Yeah, make it weapon.
Make it a weapon. We got this wonderful technology. Let's make it a weapon.
Yeah. That's one of the things that's so terribly important about Dr. Wood's book, is it shows it clear, makes it clear. I'm wondering whether she uses these exact words herself in the book. I can't remember, but I do in my foreword, that it's a demonstration to the world of somebody having harnessed this force and turned it into having weaponized it.
Actually, here's a pertinent quote from Bearden's Scalar Wars, The Brave New World of Scalar Electromagnetics. In this world of contemporary times, all the agencies, CIA, FBI, KGB, NSA, Electric Power Research Institute, DARPA, Brookings Institute, Henry Kissinger, Henry Teller et al are aware of free energy researcher Bruce De Palma and his ideas. Because these individuals and institutions are employed by the ruling elite to forecast the future and satisfy present needs and demands, it is clear that free energy is a threat to the new world constructed by business and the mindset of those who want to own the world. Free energy represents man's aspirations and dreams of freedom and equality, uniform division of resources, and the ability to choose one's own future. The fact that free energy is suppressed speaks to the greed and self-interest of a ruling elite, which, in the face of an emergency of global starvation, resource depletion, and environmental pollution, will not give one inch if it means loss of control. The attitude of paranoid delusion and fantasy, which can only arise from the alienation of a class of elitists who, through their money, are completely insulated from the reality of the day-to-day fight for existence of the common man.
Tell me again, is this Bearden you're reading? Or a book?
Yes. Now, this was actually from the link below that. It says De Palma, DEPALMA dot PAIR dot com, and then it has a link to The Problem of Free Energy. This is from something of Scalar Wars, The Brave New World of Scalar Electromagnetics, Tom Bearden.
Oh, Tom Bearden, okay. I'm most interested in all of this, as should the entire public, especially now, that they have got Dr. Judy Wood's book to get them started.
Dr. Judy Wood's work cannot be overstressed, or even what I talked to earlier about her style of educating, where she directly involves the students. And that's what we are now. We are students of this psychological warfare that is called 9/11. And the story is just so incredible. You know, there is not one tenth of a second of their official story that is supported by any kind of evidence or rational thought or anything. And I think that at this point, 10 years later, we saw right away, oh, the whole thing about the night. You know, first of all, they said they had no idea it could happen, and then after it happens, they bring up the magical 19 hijackers, and then a week later, we find that 8 of them are alive, and one of them is a commercial pilot who is banging on his American consulate wanting an explanation as to why he's referred to as a suicide hijacker. And, you know, this happened right away, and here it is 10 years later. And for there still to be people even buying any of this, I think it's not a very good commentary. It is like completely mentally, intellectually, morally, psychologically, spiritually bankrupt.
I couldn't agree more. Have you ever come across a writer named Lin Dien? He's of Vietnamese extraction.
Really?
He's an American. L-I-N-H-D-I-N-H, two separate words. He publishes very often in what was known as the online journal, but now he's called the Intrepid Reporter, I think. But he writes beautifully. And I can't remember exactly what the subject of one of his essays was, but I use it in my new book.
Could you spell the name one more time, please?
Yes, L-I-N-H.
Uh-huh.
And then a space, and then D-I-N-H.
D.
Yeah, D as in David, yeah. Yeah, Lyndon. But he wrote along very much along the lines of your sentences that you just spoke.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And he said, we're dying.
Really?
Yeah. I'll forward that to you. And you'll see it also in...
Well, yeah, I did a search. There's a good bit of... actually, born in 1963, Vietnamese American poet, fiction writer, and translator.
Also photographer.
Okay, let me try to find something that looks like an actual site of his. Well, I don't know. There's a good bit of information there.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's something. And as a writer, he's extraordinary. Another book that I have an interest in is written by someone named Adam Engel. Now, I'm interested in him because I think he's a genius, and also my press has published his work. But one of his books is called I Hope My Corpse Gives You the Plague.
Oh, okay.
And it consists of his collected online essays from about 2002 or 3 on through 2005 or 6.
Uh-huh.
And they are just extraordinary. And what they do is again and again and again take up this subject of benightedness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets very angry about it, and the pieces are brilliantly written. But the reason I mention it and connect it here with Where Did the Towers Go, the first piece in the book, his wife and he knew people who died in the towers. And he then hypothesized, he tells the story about what it would be like to have died in there. And he would have, except that he refused to wear a suit. He had applied for a job. He would have been given the job if he had agreed to wear a suit and tie.
Really?
And he said no. And so he writes an essay imagining what it would have been like if he had worn the suit and tie.
Wow.
It's quite a packed, high-impact piece of writing, as they all are in that book. I want to strike that subject again, emphasize the subject of Dr. Wood's heart, her humanity, and her sense of the
agency
of...
And she's been very graceful and very in dealing with her. Like it has been some years ago, but I watched that attack interview by someone who was clearly some form of agent of some kind, and he was posing as some type of, I don't know what it was. It was probably one of those dumb 9/11 truth things or something.
He was being maligned, I see.
Yeah, it was an interview. Oh, I'm sure she would know exactly what it was, but he was just attacking her, and it was silly. It was but she carried herself and handled herself very well. I think eventually she just walked out.
Well, there's certainly the world will vindicate her with this book. I mean, she has a section at the very end called Final Thoughts.
Okay.
And may I read just part of it?
Oh, certainly.
So, we stand, she says, at the dawn of an entirely new age. By all the evidence, man has in his hands a method of disrupting the molecular basis for matter and the ability, very possibly, to split the Earth in half on a moment's notice. There's a footnote to the fact that in one day the Earth receives more energy from the sun than needed to split the Earth in half. Or it can be used to allow all people to live fruitful, constructive, and non-polluting lives through their use of free energy. Two tiny little paragraphs more.
Mm-hmm.
He who controls the energy controls the people. Control of energy, depending on what that energy is, can either destroy or sustain the planet. And so, finally, we have a choice, and the choice is real. We can live happily and fruitfully and productively, or we can destroy the planet and die, every last one of us, along with every living being on this planet. And she says that these are the reasons I've spent so much time studying the evidence of what happened on 9/11. It was a demonstration to the world of a new technology known as free energy. This is a force that can be used for demonic, ruinous, earth-destructive purposes, or it can be used for the good of us, of the earth, and of our civilizations. We have a choice, and that choice is ours. Isn't that magnificent?
Yes.
Yeah, that's just a huge testimony to hope, and hope through knowledge.
Yes.
I think that if the world were normal, this book would win the Nobel and the Pulitzer and the American Book Award and plenty of others. But I'm afraid the world isn't normal. I trust and hope and, well, whatever length of time I have still on this planet, I hope to devote to the probability that it will get better and not worse. This is certainly a grand starting point. In my foreword, I remarked that Dr. Wood really began studying 9/11 on 9/11.
Yes.
She has this story in the very beginning of standing in the lounge area of the Department of Physics.
Yes, I remember that.
Oh, yeah, okay. And watching the disappearance of the World Trade Center. And here she was, surrounded by colleagues in the sciences, particularly the physical sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the only one who had any reaction of suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
Or disbelief. So there we are. What kind of failure is that? And ever since, I've asked the question why. I mean, I should think the people in the sciences would just be hungry for this book,
mm-hmm.
for the validation and verification that it gives their field of study. But again and again and again, people say to me, well, listen, if you were teaching physics at XYZ University and you were 43 years old, and or say you were 32 years old and you were coming up for tenure, are you going to open your mouth or keep it shut?
Mm-hmm.
And this means that we're being made liars of.
Mm.
All of us are being made liars.
Mm.
And that's the thesis of my new book.
Well, there's also the complicity of the courts. There's Dr. Wood's federal Key Tom case against the contractors of the National Institute of Standards and Technology for Science and Fraud, who virtually received no notice or indication of interest other than ridicule from the so-called 9/11 truth community.
Yeah, that's a shocking thing. It's all shocking all the way around. The Supreme Court demeaned and destroyed itself in, was it January or later of 2001, after the so-called non-election or the so-called election of George Bush. But in a case again like this, and the writ of a certiorari was denied without comment, so they just threw the case out. How can this be? I mean, I thought it was a free country where expression of ideas was guaranteed by the First Amendment.
Is there any other avenue of possibility of reintroducing that, or?
I understand from Dr. Wood that it's a dead issue. I can't speak to any kind of legal
knowledge,
but it was very clearly the impression she left me with. And so there we do not go forward by that route. But now, at least, people are going to know that that case was brought. know the history of that case. I don't know.
I mean, in your letter, this open letter to the Patriots Question 9/11 says, NIST itself admitted to Dr. Wood that its report was a fraud, and not one of the contractors hired by NIST denied her allegations.
Yeah.
Then the Court of Appeals ignored the law in order to dismiss the case. What could conceivably explain the lack of interest or response by the 9/11 community? This travesty of justice, the unfounded and prejudicial derailing of Dr. Wood's case, should be of significant concern to the entire constitutional republic.
Yeah.
If laws are ignored for ease of dismissing cases, then we are no longer living in a constitutional republic. We are living no longer in a republic of laws, but in a state where factions of any kind can usurp power through ignoring or preempting laws, however ancient they may be, or however firmly embedded in the nation's founding documents.
Makes me sorry to hear it.
Hmm. Well, I guess at this point, I'm sort of forcing myself to be optimistic. I used to say, well, I'm neither pessimistic or optimistic, but I think I've decided that I have no choice but to be optimistic. It's going to be interesting the next few years. And
well, I see a good big part of my job, insofar as I have any kind of power to do so at all,
mm-hmm.
to help promote and make known this book by Dr. Judy Wood.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most hopeful and hope-bringing book that I have been aware of in a long time. In fact, maybe never.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very major high thing on my list
mm-hmm.
of reasons to be optimistic. And of course, you're right about how one has to be optimistic. What is the alternative? The alternative is immediate defeat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It ain't easy. But the more information, figure 354,
okay.
Page 339.
Okay.
And I just see it again. Immediately after World Trade Center number 2 was destroyed,
mm-hmm.
World Trade Center number 1 lathered up.
Lathered up.
Yeah, that's her phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Fuming. That comes off the whole face of the building from bottom to top. It looks actually kind of like a combination of smog and fog.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, these things are not widely known by people, that the building didn't behave as though it were being injured by anything remotely having to do with the plane crash or the fire
mm-hmm.
caused, so-called fire caused by
yes.
the so-called crash. There were brilliantly spectacularly terrifying billows of big orange flames
mm-hmm.
that burst out of each building.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really easy to arrange.
Oh yeah.
That's easy to arrange.
I can remember years ago trying to point out some of these, you know, just common sense things, and someone was actually trying to tell me there was something very special about the jet fuel, and that somehow, you know, it kind of soaked into the steel and caused it to melt, and I'm like, it's kerosene.
I know.
Okay? That's all that it is.
Yeah. I can't remember. I mean, this is gallows humor, and it's very, you know, the subject is so serious that one hardly dares or thinks it right.
Yes.
To speak lightly, but
well, you almost have to, in a sense.
You do almost have to, and so someone, and I believe that it may be in the book. Where else would I have read it? But you know, there was explosions in the lobbies, So somebody drolly remarked, "Well, that must have been some blob jet fuel. It must have filled up the top floors and then run down all the elevator shafts."
Isn't that something?
And then flowed into the lower lobby and exploded.
I mean, the lengths that someone will go, okay, who has bought into the story, who believes the story, and that they've accepted this lie. And the lengths that they will go to try to convince themselves that it's still true is just amazing. I mean, you have to grasp at things that are just in the realm of fantasy.
Yeah, I wonder. We need a top flight a psychologist who could write a book as good as Dr. Wood's book of science forensics on 9/11. Who could write a book as good explaining what you've just said. the self-deception of the public in America.
Well, right away, this business was a Terry Masson's book, you know, Hunt the Boeing or something. And I can remember seeing people, actually, I think it was in a pub, and the TV is on, and I think it was Fox News was actually reporting this. Well, why should we report this? Because it's obviously so stupid. And then people just, you know, cursing the French, and it's like, well, nobody's addressing any of the... See, in all of these cases, no one addresses anything about the data or about the logic of the argument. They just get into name-calling and all of this hyperbole, and that's supposed to be an argument or something? It's
Yes, we are a nation of non-argument and non-seeing, certainly non-inquiring.
Mm-hmm.
The lock that the mass media has... I speak of us as being in a news blackout all the time.
Uh-huh.
I think that we are. Much of my book that's coming out in a couple of weeks is a virulent attack on something, for example, the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a pack of lies.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we do? Where do we turn?
Well, actually, though, what you reminded me of was somewhere buried. Now, somebody told me it was buried down by the obituaries. It was a stillborn story. But they did report how the 1993 event at the World Trade Center was wholly orchestrated, planned, and perpetrated by the FBI, and they admitted it. But the story, of course, is buried down there, and they say, well, you know, we did admit to it, but, you know, whatever, have a nice day.
Yeah, that's, of course, that's a, what do they call that, a plausible deniability. Hmm, plausible deniability. Oh. So someday they can say, well, hey, we didn't cover up the 1993 bombing. You know?
Hmm.
But you place it someplace in the paper where it's not going to be seen. I find
the
cynicism so extreme, so great, so enormous, that I'm odd.
Hmm.
Each day I'm newly odd. By journalists, editors, broadcasters, commentators who are purveying this propaganda and this disinformation. And I don't understand how they can get up in the morning.
Well, like this Jamie McIntyre originally on that day, he said, well, there's no evidence of a plane. And then later on, when he's his feet are held with fire, he tries to explain, oh, well, yeah, there actually was a plane. And then, of course, the little missile, the three frames, all the video. I mean, the Pentagon was probably the most videotaped square footage on the planet. Okay, and we don't have any. And, of course, the FBI going to the gas station across the street and stealing the, you know, and on. They did that in Oklahoma City and of course the three frames that do show something, it's quite obviously not a Boeing, and it does show a steam vapor trail. And actually, one of my original guests years and years ago was Eric Hufschmidt. He did a very nice study. What was the name of what he did? Anyway, but he points out the physics of exhaust and missiles, and somehow the missiles carry the fuel carries their own oxygen and something like that. So that explains how they will display a steam vapor trail at ground level. And of course, now a big Boeing is not going to do that.
No.
And just, you know, on and on and on. And the things we've brought up, even in these, you know, past couple hours or so, hardly scratching the surface. And
not barely, you're right.
Yeah. And at one point, you know, this is why I started the program. And at one point, I got a little tired of it in one sense, because there's just so much of it. And I can remember listening to a program I'd done years ago, and there was just little bits of things that I'd forgotten about, all these little details, and it just goes on and on and on. And the evidence, at the very least, the evidence that disproves the official story is simply overwhelming. And there is nothing, there is no amount of data, there is nothing that even remotely supports the official story. And here it is 10 years later, and...
Also, I must say, I find myself bristling right down to the very core of myself at the line that especially, you know, so-called people who call themselves liberal or progressive, there have always been false flag attacks being used.
Exactly.
There's the Tonkin Gulf, there's the sinking of the battleship Maine, da-da-dee-da-dee-da, but that doesn't make... I mean, that's not an argument either.
Yes.
It's just, to me, that's like saying, well, hey, there's always been cancer, so don't be bothered if your mother gets cancer. Hey, there's always been cancer. Which, of course, we know there has not.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fungus.
Yes.
But let me think of a different disease, perhaps typhoid. But it's such a non-argument, and it's such an argument of what is the word I want? Disengagement. Remember when there was a time when it was in who? Well, I'm thinking back to grad school. You're reading Graham Greene or being reading who? And the great word they used was engagé.
Okay.
The thinker or the writer was engaged or not engaged.
Okay.
To be engagé was to be the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that I look for writers, intellectuals, people in the media who are engaged, and I can't find them.
Mm.
I have found one. I have found two.
Okay.
I have found Doug Herrick.
Uh-oh.
I have found Dr. Judy Wood.
Mm-hmm.
Someone whom I know through Dr. Wood. No, like, I've never met either of them in the last time. Who's a very, very, very intelligent woman.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote me not too long ago saying, you know, and she's been a 9/11er from the start.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, you know, it's getting so bad now. I think there are only two people I trust in the whole 9/11 truth movement. That's you and Dr. Wood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was very flattered.
Mm.
And it's very tough. It's very, very tough. Dan Rather, I mean, they must have had it against him from the minute he said, oh, that looks almost like what you see when there's a planned demolition of a building.
Yes.
And, boy, he didn't last a whole lot longer after that.
No.
And the way they assassinated him was so funny, I thought. It's just as funny as the assassination. And I use this metaphorically because, thank God, both of them still are alive.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an assassination of Dan Rather, just as it was an assassination of Spitzer. What is his first name? My ex-governor.
Elliot Spitzer. Yes, that was an interesting thing. I played that. There is a, let's see. Well, he wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, and it pointed out how this mortgage meltdown thing was completely and with malice aforethought caused and perpetrated by the Bush White House. Every single state, now I'm going to be slipping it, well, yes, each and every state already had laws in place to prevent all of this, but the White House specifically told them, obfuscated them somehow. And so all of this is wholly, it's just...
He was telling the truth, and he had to, metaphorically, he had to die for it.
Well, they politically assassinated him, but whatever you want to think about what he did on his own time with his own money. So, I mean...
Oh, you mean the moral...
The
moral stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's just
yeah.
That's just like putting a banana peel under the guy's foot.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm no admirer of Spitzer. I mean, he's a 9/11 cover-up politician.
Yes.
There was a petition given to him when he was still Attorney General. I don't know how many signatures it had.
Mm-hmm.
WSHC Shepherdstown.
Given to him as Attorney General, urging him to open the investigation. Again, he just sat on it and ignored it until he was out of office, until he was governor, and continued to ignore it.
Hmm.
I mean, also, there are 80, how many, was it 80,000 signatures on this later petition to open a investigation concerning itself only with breaking of New York State laws on 9/11?
I remember a Zogby poll not too long after this happened, and it was an overwhelming majority of Republicans in the state of New York who believed that the Bush cabal caused this situation.
Very possible. I mean, the proportions, the Zogby numbers are often shocking.
Mm.
You know.
But then, so that last statement, the Bush people caused it, that is the things that Dr. Judy Wood kind of gets away from, because that's kind of a supposition. I mean, they had political power. They certainly knew about what was happening as far as who is, and ultimately we should find out whose finger was actually on the button of these things. I mean...
Well, that'll happen someday.
Eventually.
If we survive, and if things like what she has done get the proper notice that they deserve. And she's been so wise. That's what's caused her to be essentially a persona non grata inside the truth movement, that she is stuck to one thing that you really can prove, and she's proven it.
Mm-hmm.
And my list, my list is in that forward. I'm proud of it because I'm proud of her. No, you want to hear it?
Oh, certainly.
Let us make a list of the things that Dr. Wood proves in Where Did the Towers Go?
Mm-hmm.
Proves not just beyond reasonable doubt, but beyond any doubt whatsoever. So, first, that the official or government explanation for the destruction of the World Trade Center on 9/11 is scientifically false through and through. Second, that the World Trade Center buildings were not destroyed by heat generated from burning jet fuel or from conventional burning, in quotes, of any other substance or substances. Third, that the World Trade Center buildings were not destroyed by mini nuclear weapons. Fourth, that the World Trade Centers were not destroyed by conventional explosives of any kind, be they TNT, C4, or RDX, nor were they destroyed by welding materials such as thermite, thermate, or nanothermite. And fifth, that there was in fact no high heat at all involved either in bringing about the destruction of the buildings or generated by the destruction of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a lot, seems to me. Now then let us turn out of what she proves beyond any reasonable doubt,
mm-hmm.
which would be a sufficiently high level, bar for court. So she proves that the kinds of evidence left behind, and then I list them, the weird fires,
mm-hmm.
Glowing beams, molten metal without heat, levitation and flipping of mm-hmm. extremely heavy objects, including cars and other vehicles,
mm-hmm.
patterns of scorching that cannot have been caused by conventional, quote, fire,
mm-hmm.
the sudden exploding of objects, people, vehicles, and steel tanks. You know, she's hoping to follow this up with a second book that is going to be more about the people and the toll of what happened to them, what was done to them. But this thing about exploding steel tanks, firemen all have this thing called Scott packs.
Yes.
So they're steel tanks for oxygen, and they just pop, 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 pop,
mm-hmm.
all over the place. And so did there's eyewitness testimony to the effect that whole vehicles just exploded. And also, all around, you know, the cars that you were talking about early on in our conversation.
Yeah.
In many of them, the engine blocks are just missing.
Yes.
They just disappeared.
The engines, yes.
Particularly dissociated, while the rest of the car is still there. And in some cases, there are even things in the front seat that ought to have been destroyed.
Yes.
Like pieces of paper or carbon, mm-hmm. Paper coffee cups. But anyhow, so she says she proved beyond any reasonable doubt. Having had to do with the near complete absence of rubble after the power destruction.
Oh, yes.
But instead, the presence of entire buildings worth of dust, both airborne and heavier than air. And so, she proved these. Through these, none of this could have been created by conventional oxygen-fed fire,
mm-hmm.
nor by conventional explosives, nor by nuclear fission. And there you are. But at the same time, she shows that all of them are in keeping with the patterns and traits of directed energy power.
Yes. And I think that's a really good way to sum this up, sort of even scratched the surface, I think. But Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go? Mr. Eric Larson. Now, your site, let's say your site is ericlarson.info, and also OliverOpenPress.com.
Yeah, ericlarson.info is pretty much in a state of desuetude right now.
So oh, okay.
The OliverPress.com.
OliverOpenPress.com.
Yeah, that's the one where the action is.
Hmm. Well, yeah, is there anything else you'd like to say to sum that up? It's been a long time since I've spoken with Dr. Wood, and in one sense, you know, she's produced so much, and I guess one thing where I've almost lost interest, but it's like you go over this and you go over it, and
There
most of this data and evidence has been there from the beginning. Where do we go from here? Actually, my last conversation I had with Andrew Johnson was just, instead of talking about all these different details, it was talking about the psychological warfare.
It's like that is a whole thing in and of itself. But, you know, he's got a lot of things going. He's done a lot of outstanding work in presenting Dr. Wood's research. And of course, his site is checktheevidence.com.
Checktheevidence.com. A hugely important site.
Yes.
I was looking for the spot in summary in my forward, but I'm afraid I can't find it. But first, I would say that what we have been given in Where Did the Powers Go is the book of the century, and I mean that in every way. The second thing I wanted to cite in that, my own words, and I can't do it, is that now the disinformation and the infiltration and the quarreling and the out-psychologizing of one another that is the hallmark now of the truth movement will end.
Yes.
There's no reason for it not to end. If the book can be seen broadly and widely enough. And it seems to me that anybody who tries from within, inside the movement, tries to denigrate or malign or smear or scoff at this book in a nation where there were enough educated people would be made a fool of. And that's the question, of course, is whether we've reached that sort of, I don't use this term usually, but sometimes they have to, if we've reached that point of critical mass where there aren't yet left enough people with enough education to catch it. But assuming, I'll try to be optimistic.
Yes, try to be optimistic.
The book can't be attacked without for the attacker looking.
Yes. Right, sir. Well, Mr. Eric Lawson, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been very, very pleasant, though I can't say that the subject is pleasant.
No, it's not.
The extraordinary achievement is most welcome.
Yes, sir. All right,
thank
sir.
Thank you for asking.
Yes, thank you. Bye-bye.